Thank you very much to all three speakers. I would like to ask them to come up, and we do the same thing as yesterday. We collect a few questions, and then the speakers can respond to it. So there's microphones. Okay, a yellow and a green one. Any questions or comments?
Hi, my name is Esther, and I'm a student of urban planning. And I have a question for Susan, I think. And you spoke about diversity and equity, and these are two things that in my planning education have been addressed again and again, particularly in housing. And the idea was often to generate, you know, more diverse and equitable. Housing. And in the United States, I think this often happened one of the main ideas was maybe to bring more social housing into maybe more middle-income neighborhoods to generate a kind of diversity, and at least economic, maybe. And I'm wondering, but to me there always seems to be sort of a counterforce between this sort of diversity, because maybe if left by themselves, people are probably more likely, and I think they already do, group themselves residentially in terms of lifestyle, or similar kinds of people tend to live maybe in similar kinds of areas. And I'm wondering if you think of it in terms of similarity instead of diversity, how do we think of this in terms of housing without starting to generate polarization or this extreme sort of differences in rich and poor that was trying to be avoided when we talk about diversity.
Thank you. There's a question over here.
Yes, Felicitas Hillmann, Universität of Bremen. I would have a question to Susan too. And it's quite in the same direction as your question. So you were talking about the crucial issues for planners, dispersal of the poor or people of color, immigrant groups, and the social mix as being one of the central questions in the near future. Do you see already a tendency among the planners of a changed awareness of the importance of the social mix in their planning ideas? Because I would say I see that already. That there's a pronunciation of this social mix, that there's an awareness about these social problems you have to integrate into your planning culture.
Okay, thank you. Next question.
Dike Peters, I'm here with the Center for Metropolitan Studies in Berlin. I think this is a question to all of you, but maybe mostly to Catherine, since you had sort of the praxis of planning in your title. I think so the emphasis of the commons or the contributions has mostly been about sort of what planners should or could do or might do and their position and sort of, you know, the overall theme of rights to the city. And I just wanted to ask, what about planning sort of as a mere system of rules and regulation? I mean, the system of planning itself is obviously very much impacting people's ability to exercise their right of access or life in the city. So, I mean, it's just sort of a basic question, not of planners, but planning as a system, you know, the basics, and the way that you organize zoning and everything else. I mean, the way that I'm able to move around in the city obviously is impacted by policy and planning. So I wondered if any of you wanted to comment on that particular system versus in the people exercising it.
There were a couple more questions. This person here and then over there.
Thank you very much. I actually have two questions. One is still dealing with the integration or the word concept. I'm not sure because I'm really disturbed by it as it is used so much as a goal or something, and I don't know. I think as long as there's this idea of integrating one thing into the other, it's just, you know, what's the goal behind that? There's always a problem of domination and hierarchy comes into play. And the other one is, I'm very grateful for the new geographic perspective that you brought in. And I'm wondering, what about tourists? Because you talked about Colombo in Sri Lanka, and I was wondering if there's a relation that can maybe also be true for American cities, when there's a lot of money and planning and energy put into the tourist areas and spaces. And for example, for hotels, if I'm a tourist, I can go to a city and I can be really angry if there's no bed waiting for me. But I think if I live in the places that you have shown us in the pictures, if they get mad, they don't have a bed, you know, that it's not even a right.
Thank you. One more question and then we let the panels answer and then another round of questions, please.
Okay. Good morning. I'm Daniela De Leo from Italy. And I have a question for Oren Giftekel because I'm just start to study some kind of gray space, space like he called them, and some different one, however, but connected with legal or illegal, or like following the Weber description about legitim and illegitim. And my question is, what kind of policies and action we can really are really possible in the gray space, or what, and which one is our abilities like planner to deliver these kind of policies?
Thank you. Now our panelists, who wants to start?
Well, the questions for me all revolved really around this question of social mix, and is this something we wish to, that we, is desirable to bring about or not? One argument that my husband actually made to me was, well, these places in the United States like Levittown, or in general new developments wherever, that if they're socially integrated to begin with, there's not really a big problem. The big problem is that people are already clustered, and they're clustered, as one of the commentators said, partly involuntarily, what Peter has called the ghetto, but partly voluntarily, what Peter, in his various work on the quartered city, has called the enclave. And on the one hand, I think it's probably not desirable to break up enclaves. On the other hand, if people are stuck in ghettos and want to get out, then shouldn't we be facilitating their getting out? But if we're facilitating it, can we do that without running into enormous political conflict? What do you do about the resistance of existing communities to this kind of integration? And this is why there's so much tension between actually democracy and tolerance. Nancy Fraser, in her work, distinguishes between redistribution and recognition. So one of the things that we know is that equity and segregation are, or lack of equity and segregation are imbricated, and that's why the discussions yesterday having to do with gentrification and the arguments of, say, Lance Freeman, that people in poor neighborhoods in certain ways benefit from gentrification, because if everybody in a neighborhood's poor, politically they're in a bad position. But on the other hand, then you have the extreme costs of gentrification, so that these are very difficult issues, and planners are thrust right into the middle of them, and to some extent they're not soluble within the, or to a large extent they're not soluble within the confines of planning. But nevertheless, planners still have to face this question of what to do. And I guess I'd say what to do first is never to move anybody involuntarily, that would be one of my rules and my set of rules having to do with somewhat universal planning. And I was thinking, as Oren was discussing a different perspective, I'm not sure how non-Western that perspective really is. That is, it was a perspective that talked about places that weren't in the West, but the arguments, the general ideas about voluntarism and involuntarism or freedom come very much out of Western political philosophy. I don't see them as being particularly from some other part of the world. And so I think I could make a universal rule which says don't displace people involuntarily, whether I'm talking about Sri Lanka or talking about Holland.
Thank you. Oren, you want to reply?
Okay, thank you. Susan also threw in another question in her answer, which is a nice chain reaction. I think basically on the question of the general question of system versus people and the issue of education, I'm very much in the mold that was spoken over the last 2 days, that one cannot separate theory from praxis. And this is also the Peter Marcuse's line that has inspired so many of us. So I very much believe in urban studies rather than planning. And if planning has to be a department, it's better be in geography rather than with the architects. So there is a possibility of exposing the students, actually taking them, actually writing with them, actually exercise that I do quite often is writing a constitution with the students, an urban constitution. And then things start to surface about what they feel should be the right city, the just city perhaps, maybe the right city is another possibility. And then the contradictions start to surface, the Western, non-Western, which is quite important to the question of what to do or what to be done. Quite often there is a different type of politics, like Laila Abu Lurod was saying, when you talk to the people, they don't want liberal rights. In fact, they don't want the right to the city sometimes. They phrase it very differently. They want capabilities. I totally agree. This is already a semi-non-Western, definitely non-liberal formulation. They want materiality. They want community very much. We formulated the idea of multiple sovereignties. This beginning with my work in Australia with Aborigines. They don't accept the authority of the state. Huh? That's a non-Western perspective. We are not going to be perhaps totally one polity. We don't want equal citizenship, but we don't want to be downtrodden and colonized. So the idea of multiple sovereignties in the city maybe goes back to some anarchist thinking, maybe recluse and people like this that you might argue whether they're Western or non-Western, but they come from Indian thinking, from Arab thinking, and from African thinking now. But obviously influenced by the West, there is no dichotomy between the West and the non-West. The ideas flow around. So in that respect, I would the question of what to do is first and foremost go and talk to everybody around in a genuine sense. Think about sovereignty, not as a state concept, but as a community concept with its material implication. This is what I asked Neil Smith yesterday. It's not that difficult to imagine actual sovereignty with tax rights, land rights, for particular communities to govern themselves, at least as a horizon, and think about that as gradually, yes, gradually shifting the urban reality.
Thank you. Catherine also wants to respond.
Hi. Okay, thanks for the question. You know, I have to say, whenever it comes to thinking about systems, whether it's planning systems or development systems, I can't not occupy the subjectivity of the critic. You know, and it's partly because I've never worked or been inspired by systems that I have viewed to be transformative, right? So, so the work I've and my work is about whether it's in the context of North America or South Asia. It's about looking at systems as governmental technologies, right, in the Foucauldian sense of neoliberalism, right, the shift from state-led to market-led approaches to development, and then in turn the ways in which these systems aim to produce self-regulating subjects, right? So my answer to you is that I suppose it sort of echoes what Oren just said, you know, that I feel a bit tired or weary of that, of being in that position of the critic all the time. And for me, the inspiration for how to think critically, and also for how to develop the political will to change the systems, lies in engagement with communities. That is why I didn't talk about systems, because in Toronto, the planning establishment has absolutely been complicit in processes of gentrification.
Thank you. We are running out of time, but there was one more question. Are there other questions at this point?
Okay. My name is Maria Gudelo, and I'm from the TU Berlin for urban design and landscape architecture. And I have a question, because 2 weeks ago or a week ago, I was really shocked as I discovered a plan for the Valley of Peace and territories between Israel and Palestine and Jordan. And I wanted just to ask you about more information about that, because as soon as in the territories there you build something, because a territory is not that big, so you have backdoors possibility so soon. So you build something and it has a front, but it has a back as well. So you were talking about the screen gray areas, and gray areas are very connected to centers and periphery. So I read about this project, which is building a canal, a channel between the Dead Sea and the Red Sea, and bring development in the area. And this is in a really close way to Dubai or China, but the political conditions in the territories is really, in Israel and Palestine and Jordan is really different than in Dubai or in China, but it's the same kind of planning. So I'm just really shocked and curious about your opinion about that.
Thank you. There's one more question. Peter, please.
I'm concerned that there is a point that it seems to me is inherent in the right to the city idea that gets lost when we talk about general principles without saying who is affected by them. There are two quite different definitions of democracy. One sees it as a matter of procedure, as a process of decision-making, and does not look at who is involved. The original and linguistic definition of democracy is rule by the people. That is, the question is who is making the decisions, not so much how are the decisions being made. And it seems to me that runs through all of these issues. The diversity issue is very much a question of who is benefiting from it and who is hurt. A diversity in which poor people move into wealthier neighborhoods is quite different from the diversity that gentrification produces when rich people move into poorer neighborhoods. Both of them in general produce diversity, but for different people. No one should ever be displaced involuntarily. I would guess Aaron would take the position that Jewish settlements in Gaza were properly displaced because of it was the dominant class that was displaced from places they had no right to be. So it seems to me who's involved needs to be integrated in each of these things. When Catherine speaks of communities, she's speaking of particular kinds of communities. She's not talking about gated communities. She's talking about neighborhoods of normal people, but in any case not of the elite.
Thank you. Quick responses, very brief.
Peter, you really caught me on that one, because, yes, of course, the settlers in the West Bank should be displaced. But I think there's a certain problem also of saying, well, we'll talk to communities, but by the communities, we mean only the communities that we see as disadvantaged, and we're not going to talk to the upper middle class or middle class communities, and that everybody's, I mean, Peter and I and David and Neil and others belong to this Right to the City discussion group in New York, and I'm always struck that in the conversations in this group, there seem to be exist only the people who are the downtrodden, and the rest of the people, the middle class, is sort of either a non-existent group, or they're just playing the bad guys. And that I don't think you can have a conception of democracy that leaves out what Michael Harlow likes to call the middle mass, and to say, well, the middle mass is selfish and greedy and gets too much, and so we can just ignore them, because democracy actually does refer to all the people, not just the people who are treated inequitably, and that's why it's such a problematic concept, but on the other hand, it is also the case that when you have institutionalized participation, that these are the people who tend to participate. When Catherine says, Catherine and Oren say, well, we should listen and we should talk to communities and find out what they want. But I know that the communities they're talking about are only certain communities and not others, and we may consider them the more deserving, while I would think that plenty of the rest of the population probably considers them the less deserving. So this is a problem that has to be dealt with, not simply that we know who are the good guys and the bad guys. But certainly you're right, Peter, that there are people who ought to be displaced.
Thank you. A couple of quick responses, very brief. Oren and Catherine.
Yeah, on that last point, I think obviously there should be a balance between communities, all communities that should be addressed, apart from those who are, you know, colonized by force that appears to be totally illegitimate, like, you know, the thief in your apartment, and when you return home should be evicted, right? There are certain boundaries, but beyond that, of course, the situation is much more subtle. But here is also a perspective of the Southeast, the global South and the East I put together, of course, with enormous diversity, but the enormity of the dispossession, the gravity of it, I think leaves most planners to be on one side. The middle and upper classes will look after themselves. It's when you see this kind of deprivation, I think planning is needed there, and it's not needed elsewhere. They're looking after themselves quite well. And this is the difference to Western democracies, where you have to be much more subtle in that. So, you know, look at my students, I look at what the good city they want to be, invariably, whatever horizon they want, they would decide to go and work with the people who are mostly deprived. I formulate, following David Harvey, the idea also of democratizing not only the surplus, but also democratizing the regime of identities. And this is something that, again, in the West, people are very uneasy about because of the liberal conception. But in the East, where people are born into tribes, and quite often this is not necessarily negative, the regime of identities becomes very important, of course, with the presumption that it will be equality between identities. But I think in the management of the new city, the new metropolis, which is characterized by this influx of multitude of groups, I think this becomes a must for planners to try to deal with that, because the urban apartheid, what I'm talking about, is the technique of the elites, not just in Israel-Palestine, that was my point, is to deal with unwanted populations. Sometimes they want the labor, often they don't. So all this gray space is about planning tools to deal with the unwanted. The unwanted is there. So I think this is a real challenge for critical theory to widen its horizons and include these peoples and cities. Maybe to finish with a leaf again from Walter Benjamin from the Frankfurt School, that he was warning people from the dialectic instill. I don't know what it was called in German, but it's sitting there and hoping that the dialectics will do their work and the revolution will come. Walter Benjamin says, no, you have to work into these dialectics every day, and those small little movements hopefully will bring the change.
Thank you. Catherine, very quick, briefly.
You're right. Communities, I'm not talking about elite communities, I'm talking about communities where, though there are elite people or middle class people, And so I'm saying that I think it is a political challenge to, when wants to, as a planner, promote a progressive agenda, right? Anti-gentrification agenda. It's a challenge to get people, differently positioned people in communities, to see their interests in aligned with an anti-gentrification agenda, and that the to come back to democracy, you know, the goal here is actually to push the limits of a liberal understanding of democracy to one that would extend, that would challenge, you know, the false separation of the political and the economic, and that would extend into the domain of the economy. But I don't see how to do that without confronting the challenge of conscientization or political will.
Thank you very much. Let me thank the panelists for staying within their time and for this very interesting discussion early in the morning. So thank you to all. We will reconvene at 11:15. Enjoy your break.